I really like the informal setting. So as Elliot said, I'm Danielle Leonard. I'm a postdoc at Carnegie Mellon. And I'm going to be talking today about some work that I did last year with Phil Bull, who is at JPL. I know he's visited here a few times, so maybe some of you have met him. And Rupert Allison, who is postdoc at Cambridge. And so, yeah, I'm going to be talking about sort of what we can hope to achieve in terms of constraints on spatial curvature with near future and further future planned surveys and observations. Since we're in this kind of more informal setting, actually, maybe I can get a sort of gauge of what people's backgrounds are so that I don't maybe over-explain things that you already know all about or assume you might know something if it's not in your background. So who would consider themselves to be any kind of an observational cosmologist at all? Okay, so not too many. Okay, so I'll try not to skip over any of the sort of background concepts then with respect to the observational stuff. So I should say, yeah, this is gonna be a primarily related to constraints. So I apologize if you are gonna be bored by not theory stuff. I know coming to PI and giving something unrelated to theory is...
No, we won't be.
Okay.
Your theory is all the time.
Okay, good. Hopefully.
Still concerned about testing theories with experiments.
Good, okay.
You have this old-fashioned approach.
Things should be testable, what? Okay, good. So I've started off by just including these images of some of the future cosmological surveys and observatories we will hopefully have over the next few years, just to talk about the fact that we often discuss being in the either in the era of precision cosmology or moving towards the era of precision cosmology with surveys like Euclid and LSST and the SKA and DESI and CHIME and KIDS ongoing or in the near future. And I'm going to talk about what that means to be able to do precision cosmology from the perspective of specifically constraining omega k and discuss, I guess, in part in this talk, how many things we all need to be able to agree on as a community in interpreting results in order to actually constrain omega k down to a very precise level, which in this talk I'm going to be focusing on the idea of potentially being able to constrain omega k down to about 10 to the minus 4, because this is an interesting value for a few reasons that I'll get into. This is sometimes referred to as the curvature floor. And so there have been some claims in relatively recent times that some of these surveys might actually get there. So the objective of this work at the beginning was to see, okay, how accurate is that? Do we really think that's going to happen? And so I'm going to give away the punchline in time-honored fashion, just in case, you know, some of you have to leave or something before the end, and tell you that for surveys planned in the known future, that for the observables that we considered in this project, we won't reach the 10 to the minus 4 level for constraints on omega k. We will improve considerably on current constraints. So we're looking at maybe 5 times improvement on current constraints for planned surveys. And again, I'm going to talk about this idea of constraints on omega k and our ability to agree on the interpretation of them being potentially a litmus test for the community in terms of being ready to do true precision cosmology. So having already given away the punchline, how am I going to get there? So I'm first just going to give some background and motivation to the project, talk about why we would even care about constraining spatial curvature when it's already constrained at quite a low level, look at what other work has been done in this area, then just talk about our methods, what observables we considered, and then, of course, give you the results of the project. So first to the background. So the first question is, why care about curvature? I'm not sure if this is maybe a silly question to pose to this group. Maybe there's lots of inflationary theorists in the room who are very much care about curvature, but for people who work on maybe like late time cosmology, lensing or galaxy clustering, it might seem a bit silly because it curvature is constrained at, you know, the most recent constraints from Planck and Bloss is 0.005, so at 95% confidence level. So that's like effectively dynamically negligible at late times in many cases. And so you may be well justified in setting the sort of curvature parameter to zero when you do your analysis for your late time cosmological probes. But so I'll argue that there's a few reasons that we might still care about pushing these constraints lower. Three of them being that you can constrain inflationary models, that you might see something interesting other than curvature when you try to do this type of constraint in terms of large-scale structure effects, and that sort of a because we can argument, which is this reaching the curvature floor. By the way, yeah, feel free, obviously, to stop me at any point if you haven't. Yeah.
Around 1998, K was not zero.
Okay.
Inflation models were produced to explain this.
Okay.
Then an omega K went to zero.
Yeah.
More and more. Inflation models were produced to explain that.
Right, yeah.
So to what extent is inflation model being?
Right. So I'll talk about actually just in the very next slide. Specifically, I guess one of the motivations is these eternal inflation models. So this is a particular set that I would talk about as being potentially constrained. But you're right, obviously there are many inflationary models and you can almost do anything you want with the something from within the set. I should say I'm certainly not an expert in inflationary theory, so if you are, please be kind and or educate me. So the first thing I wanted to mention as a potential motivation is these potential constraints on these eternal inflation models. So eternal inflation being, with my sort of low-level layman's understanding, the case where you have most sort of parts of the universe expanding forever, and then sort of bubbles coming out of that phase, and that one of those areas being where we are living. And so there's a few different types of this. There's slow roll and false vacuum in particular. And in this paper by Kleban and Shillow from 2012, for example, this is the cumulative probability distribution for a few different assumptions for these eternal inflation models. And you can see it kind of drops off sharply as omega k gets greater than 10 to the minus 4. So this could potentially be quite constraining for this set of models if you were able to measure omega k at a non-zero level.
What is the vertical?
Sorry, the vertical is the cumulative probability distribution. Yeah. Or probability level, I guess.
Going back to the basic, the usual method is just like a position of the first acoustic
tape? Yeah, that's the from the CMB temperature, that is, yeah, that's the main constraint from the CMB temperature power spectrum. Yeah. Sorry, did you have another question?
Yeah, the problem is eternal inflation produces a multiverse.
Okay.
Goethe and Linter, they all agree on this.
Pardon? Oh, yeah.
So, as Paul Steiner said, he calls it a multiverse.
Yeah.
Steiner keeps saying, we don't actually predict anything.
Okay.
So this result is,
okay.
What does it mean?
Why
10 to the minus 4? It's particularly set up this way. There are 100 other ways of doing it.
So, right, yeah. So I mean, yeah, I guess I would have to go back through the paper and look at it, and we can talk about it if you want.
I mean, that's a slightly... Me defending the eternal inflation on this is a little silly, but I mean, that's a slightly hyperbolic statement, right? That it could just produce anything.
Well,
a Okay, it's probably better as a language discussion.
Great to share this.
Okay, yeah, we can talk about this after if you want.
I don't want to interrupt.
Sure. Thanks. Yeah. Again, I'm not necessarily an expert on this aspect, so I appreciate the comments. Okay, so another reason, which is less related directly to theory perhaps, but still interesting, is that, okay, but the current way we would constrain omega k, if we were to see something at a low level, okay, we might be seeing evidence for a non-flat universe, but we could also be seeing a number of different things. So this acts sort of inadvertently as potentially a probe of a number of different large-scale structure effects. So this is obviously a downside in one way because, you know, you don't know for sure if you're actually seeing curvature or if you're seeing something else. But it could be that if we did measure something, we might be detecting large-scale local inhomogeneities. You might be seeing a necessity to go to higher order terms in your redshift distance relationship. You might be seeing large-scale structure relativistic effects. You might be seeing effects from supersample modes. So that's not necessarily interesting in the same way as sort of the fundamental quantity of the of spatial curvature, but it still could be of use if we did measure this sort of low-level deviation from zero with omega k. And this is related to the idea of these types of constraints potentially serving as a litmus test for being able to do this precision cosmology. Is we have, if we did see a non-zero effect, would we agree that it was a deviation from a flat universe? We'd have to really go through and check all these different kinds of effects. Okay, and the third reason we might still care about curvature is the idea that there have been some statements that maybe we're going to reach this curvature floor, and so why not just do it and, like, you know, finish it to some extent. So some of you might be thinking, why is she saying curvature floor is 10 to the minus 4? I thought that you could measure omega k down to around 10 to the minus 5. And so the 10 to the minus 5 value comes from the fact that the horizon scale perturbations are expected to be around 10 to the minus 5. And so if we did measure omega k at a lower level than that, that's not necessarily a deviation from flat. That's potentially just, you know, within what we expect from perturbations. The 10 to the minus 4 is from considering from a sort of Bayesian model. What is the word I'm looking for? Sort of being able to tell the difference between models from a Bayesian statistics perspective. So we would want to look at a quantity called the Bayesian evidence of the two different models and compare them. And, oh, sorry, I should say in this scenario, what I mean by two different models is that we're not really just trying to constrain omega k. We're also trying to distinguish between a curved universe model and a flat universe model, the curved universe model having one additional parameter. So in Bayesian statistics, if you are looking at it from that perspective, you would look at the evidence for the two models, so the probability of the model given the data. And you would find that in this case, these quantities depend on, for example, okay, so if you assume, this is from a paper by Verdanian et al. In 2009, so let's say we assume a fiducial non-zero value of the true value of omega k, which is the along the x-axis here. And we assume that we have some level of constraint on omega k, which is along the y-axis here. So these two quantities go into what the evidence is for these models in terms of that's the probability of the model given the data. And we find that there's a region, which is this model confusion region here, in which the Bayesian evidence calculation tells you that you should have a flat universe while you know that you've assumed that you have a non-flat universe. So that's telling you that you can't tell the difference reliably for those parameters. And you can do better, right? Your region of model confusion decreases as you get better and better constraints on omega k. So that's like going down. You have all this extra white space here where you get, for higher values of omega k, you get better model selection, but you can't reduce your constraint on omega k below 10 to the minus 5. like we just said. So you get down eventually to that level, and you're, you still can't tell the difference between a flat model and a curved model if your true value is less than whatever it is, 8 times 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 4. Sorry, did you have a question? Was that a question? Yeah.
I have a positive statement.
Okay.
what you're checking is the lambda CDM model across the board.
Right, so
all
yeah.
The omegas add up to 1.
Yes, yes.
Plus omega.
Well.
Plus omega k.
I think it's that the omega, all the omegas other than omega k add up to 1, right? And then the omega
is,
there's so like an equation with a 1 in it that relates them all. Yeah.
Fit the matter power spectrum structure growth. And that only fits if omega k is small.
Yes.
That's the end result. So this is very important.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. So, okay. So, I should probably like maybe I think I'm going quite slowly.
So the prior here, you just assume some flat prior.
So there's two priors. They in this paper they look at flat in they try to do uninformative priors. So they look at flat in a flat prior in linear space and a flat prior in log space. And so the two different colors on the edges of the model confusion region are actually the two different priors. So it does make a slight difference, but it's not much. OK. So to continue with the background, because I think I'm taking forever. Sorry. So just to give a quick sort of, this is like the motivation. So where was this sort of like field of what are we going to do with omega k when we came into the this project, and like what were we thinking when we started trying to do this? Because I think this is important to distinguish what we've done here from what already existed. So in around 2015, when we started looking at this, there had been in the past few years quite a lot of interest in what these future surveys would be doing with omega k, and also some like more recent current constraints. And I'll give a couple of examples of this quickly in the next few slides. But the sort of summary is that there was a lot of interest, and most of the papers were looking at specific cases. So maybe you worked on a particular survey, or you were going to be working on a particular survey, and you were like, "What can my survey do for constraints on curvature? Let me check into that." Or I'm interested in this particular degeneracy. Let's see how well we can break that with X, Y, and Z data. So a lot of good work and kind of specific work. So, for example, this is a paper from 2015 by Takada and Dore looking at BAO, baryonic acoustic oscillation, forecast constraints on omega k. So depending on the redshift, maximum redshift of the survey, depending on the assumptions you make about the gravity theory and the dark energy equation of state, and depending on the density of galaxies in your survey, you know, you can get, they were forecasting some pretty impressive constraints. In this case, they fixed the neutrino mass. So I'm going to use some words that might be maybe more for more sort of jargony for observational stuff. So just in case these words are not familiar, so I'm going to use the words vary and marginalize quite a bit in the next bit of the talk. So when I say that, so when I'm here, I'm saying like in this particular paper, they fixed the neutrino mass. What I mean by that is they assume that they have zero uncertainty on the neutrino mass when they did their forecast. When I say, if I said they varied or they marginalized over the neutrino mass, what I mean is that they incorporated the uncertainty. So you're going to have a looser constraint when you incorporate more uncertainties on auxiliary parameters. So just in case those terms aren't familiar to anybody. Okay, here's another example. In this case, this was a paper that looked specifically at the known degeneracy between omega k and the dark energy equation of state. So there's this geometric degeneracy where in projection you can kind of sort of compensate for changing the spatial curvature by changing the equation of state. And they look specifically at this using BAO and CMB as their observables. And they varied, you know, most of the parameters, and they fixed these three parameters.
Does it not require breaking of the homogeneity that we are in a spatial space?
Doesn't what require it? Sorry.
Interchanging, like mixing between curvature and the equation of state.
You mean having both at this in the same framework?
Same,
or?
Saying that they are degenerate.
Oh.
Changing one to changing the other are totally degenerate. Doesn't that break, does that need to break homogeneity?
Does it?
So we are in the center of somewhere that. So what I know is that you can totally replace lambda by curvature if you give up homogeneity. You say we are in a special place, it's not homogeneous, but we looked out curvature, spread in the right way to make omega higher.
But I don't think she's trading an homogeneity for, I don't think she's trading lambda for curvature. She's saying there's a degeneracy between, and the redshift history between.
Yeah, I think it has to be,
w
yeah.
And
well, but W, different value of W is like changing the lambda.
So in this case, I'm only showing the W naught, but in this paper they looked at, you know, they looked at a redshift-dependent parameterization of W, and they also looked at W in bins and redshift. I think the degeneracy is increased when you have a redshift dependence in the dark energy equation of state.
W is not the, you mean?
So the W here, is that the effective?
This is W like the, this is P is equal to
yeah.
W rho.
The total.
So it would be minus one for the cosmological constant, regardless of its amplitude, regardless of its size.
Mm-hmm.
So this is changing this, is changing how it scales the bridge.
This W is P equals minus rho. Lambda is due to vacuum energy. W is equal to minus one.
In lambda CDM.
Yeah,
in lambda CDM.
So omega matches K. But the point is that we're checking a specific model of lambda CDM.
In this case, they were looking at lambda CDM plus with extensions.
Some of them yeah. One, this particular model where you assume FRW.
Yes, yes. For the background, yes,
right.
Yes.
But there are other models.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Where conformation omegas. It's not the one in the same way.
Sure, okay, yeah.
And one example is something called white cosmology.
Yeah.
Where omega lambda is zero. So,
right, and then how would you compensate for that?
Well, you, the lambda fits the angular power spectrum, the matter power spectrum, pretty well fits everything. There
okay.
are some issues.
Anyway. It's called void cosmology. Is that
it's
what you said?
Void.
Yeah.
Void or void?
We were trying to place a cosmological factor with an inhomogeneous universe.
Okay.
Although I think it's safe to say that most people are convinced this.
The problem is.
Is this like a large local inhomogeneity?
Yeah,
or?
We have a bubble.
Yeah, I've heard about this.
Bubble.
Yeah.
We sit near the center.
So this is actually related to what I was saying about potential other effects we could. So if there was a. If we were, you know, assuming the wrong thing, like you're saying, and then we measure omega k non-zero, that would be an indication that maybe there's something else going on, and we'd have to go check all those things. So that's kind of part of what I was saying about.
Well, the trouble is that it doesn't really. When you do the other model, you do different things. So
yeah, it's not. I know it's not perfectly consistent. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I guess within this project, we were kind of, you know, working with the assumption that, we're basically looking at lambda CDM plus extensions.
Two big question marks of lambda CDM, standard model. It's dark matter, dark energy.
Absolutely.
You don't really understand.
Absolutely, yeah.
So particularly, this is why there are 1,000 models.
Yeah.
Dark energy.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, so I should say everything with the caveat that yeah,
it's
we're looking within.
Very important to check that model.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we should definitely talk more about that after, though. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to press on because I'm taking a while. So, yeah, just the third example. This is another work that came out last year. This is actually constraints rather than forecasts, and this one looked at CMB baryonic acoustic oscillation and supernova data. And in this case, they actually didn't fix the neutrino mass. That was the reason I just wanted to show this one. So these are just examples. The point that I'm trying to make, and obviously there are many more examples, the point that I'm trying to make is that people make different choices about which parameters they care about, including uncertainty on which parameters they're interested in looking at the degeneracies with. And so sort of the idea behind this work was that we kind of looked at what had been done and said, wow, there's like a lot of great work here, but it's hard to get a big picture. It's hard to kind of take all these papers together and see, have an idea of, okay, if I care about, constraints on curvature at X point in the future, and in my particular like bit of, in my, the things that I care about, like I can't fix W to minus one, or I really care about the neutrino mass. We thought it would be really helpful to do a sort of thorough forecasting study where we included a wide variety of extension parameters to lambda CEM, as well as some parameters describing potential systematic error effects observationally, and looked at a series of current surveys, near future surveys, further future surveys, kind of so that all of the information was in one place. And we could easily describe, okay, well, this is the effect you're seeing when you fix this parameter. This is the effect you're seeing when you fix that parameter. These are the actual reasons that your constraints are behaving in this way or the other way. So that was kind of the motivation. So that's the end of the background section. Were there any other questions at that stage before I move on? Yeah, sure.
I apologize for interrupting.
That's okay.
Is it possible to get a minimal model determination of a mega kick?
What do you mean by a minimal model?
Minimal, just using.
Oh, just like less model dependent? Sure.
Trigonometry.
So, I mean, I think that's kind of the. So, I think that's the cleanest probes, and I'll kind of get into this during this section. I would say most people feel like the cleanest probes, if that's what you're going for, is CMB temperature and baryon acoustic oscillations. And because those are mostly geometric is kind of what you're getting at, right? You don't want to have to model nonlinear structure formation. You don't want to have to model supernova behaviors. Is that kind of what you mean?
I think he's trying to ask, what can you get down to the level you want to get without making particular theory type of raw theory type assumptions?
Minimal. Everything is model dependent. I think that's often a minimal way of determining something.
Right.
Minimal model.
So you mean like without assuming that? Yeah. Okay. So we didn't look at that. Actually, I think I would say that of those examples that I showed, I think that actually the Takata and Dore paper make an attempt at this. So these lines here, the solid ones that say geometry, I think that's an attempt at seeing how well you can do without trying to make those assumptions. I'd have to look at the paper again, but that might be an example. Okay, so let me quickly summarize our methods and the observables that we considered. Okay, so as I've been saying, this is kind of a forecasting work. So the point of forecasting is to take information that you have about a potential future survey or observation, in particular the errors on the observable and the covariances on the observable between for that observation, which we might call the data in this case, and convert that information into information about the constraints on the parameters that you care about that you're likely to get. So we do this using a form of forecasting called Fisher forecasting, which is it's sort of based around this Fisher information matrix quantity. So just to take you through it quickly, maybe this is totally familiar to everyone, not sure. So the curly L is the likelihood of the data, which is the observable, given the fiducial assumed parameters. So one caveat to Fisher forecasting is that you do have to assume a fiducial model. So maybe that's not good if you don't want to be too model dependent. So then you So this is basically, this likelihood is the probability that you get the data that you get, or that you assume that you get. So it's the probability that you get the data with the noise properties that you assume for your survey, given the parameters. Then you take a derivative in this, log derivative with respect to the parameters that you care about, and you get this Fisher matrix. And it turns out that within the assumptions of uninformative priors, so you don't have extra information that you're not putting into this, the Fisher matrix approximates the inverse parameter covariance matrix. So you put information in about the data, you get information out about hopefully roughly what your constraints might be on the parameters you care about. So you can kind of see why that works, because you're taking a derivative with respect to the parameter values of something that tells you about how the data, how likely you are to get the data. So that intuitively makes some sense. And then, so the next question is, what observables did we actually look at when we did this sort of broad survey of what constraints we might be able to get? So like I was just saying, most people would probably consider CMB and BAO, baryon acoustic oscillations, to be the sort of cleaner probes available in terms of not being dependent on nonlinear physics and being sort of well-studied in terms of systematics. So we chose to go with CMB and BAO. We also chose to include weak lensing. So this was for a number of reasons. Like I said, we were trying to sort of stick with things that were well-studied and sort of clean. We went with weak lensing as a third probe, partially because although it's probably not as clean in the same sense as the other two, it's a huge objective for a number of upcoming surveys. So one, that's important to know what it can do to talk about what constraints can come from these surveys. And two, that means there's a huge effort at the moment going into understanding systematic errors and effects associated with it. So we have some confidence that it might be approaching the level of sort of the same kind of clean observable at some point in the foreseeable future. So we're not including things like supernova directly, partially just because of, wanting to stay a little bit less model dependent, I guess. But I'll talk about that more in a little while. Okay, so just to go over specifically what we're including for each of these. So we have causing microwave background, we have the temperature anisotropy spectrum. We're including the polarization E and B mode anisotropy spectra, and also the lensing, so you can measure the lensing of the CMB photons themselves, or the temperature spectrum, and that can give you information about the growth of structure. So that's what we include for CMB. For BAO, so just to remind you, the feature that you're looking for here is a peak in the galaxy two-point function, which is a relic of the characteristic scale of baryon correlations at the time of recombination. For BAO, I'm just going to show how we modeled this feature. So when you get this, you get it, as I just showed you, from the galaxy-galaxy correlation function and from the peak in that. This is the equivalent in Fourier space. So the important thing here, I mean, you don't have to read this whole equation if you don't want to, but the important thing is just to show you three parameters that we include that are sort of systematic, trying to include a sort of potential for systematic error effects or just unknowns. So we have a parameter that the galaxy bias we marginalize over that. So that's the relationship between the matter distribution and the galaxy distribution. We include uncertainty on the linear growth rate of structure, which goes into this model, which sometimes gets fixed. The one that's most related to the actual BAO is this alpha S, when you look at where this peak is, it's affected by nonlinear structure formation in a way that's not perfectly understood. So there's some uncertainty associated with that nonlinear growth, and this alpha S is intended to allow us to marginalize over that uncertainty. So just to introduce those parameters that we'll be talking about in a minute. So the third one is weak lensing. I think probably most of you know what this is, but it's just when you have a galaxy image that's far away, you have light from that galaxy, you observe the image of the galaxy, the light goes, you know, by other mass, and there's a gravitational lensing effect, and you have, you know, averaging over many images, the distortions can tell you something. So we looked at the shear, so that's kind of like the ellipticity two-point functions of the power spectrum on the sky. We also included two different types of potential sort of systematic error accounting for in this part of the forecasting. So we accounted for something called intrinsic alignments, which might be familiar to some of you or possibly not. So this is where you don't really know the redshifts of your galaxies particularly well sometimes. And so you might think that you see a correlation in shear due to lensing, but if in fact your galaxies are closer together in redshift or at a different redshift than what you think they are, you could just be seeing an intrinsic correlation due to them being actually just near the same dark matter overdensity, for example. So we include this type of effect of enhanced correlation, a potential enhanced correlation through just a nonlinear alignment model, which is a sort of typical model to use for this. And we have one free parameter, which is the amplitude of the correlation. We also try to include some accounting for the idea of photometric redshifts. So if you aren't familiar with this, it's the fact that, you know, when you're trying to get redshifts for galaxies, you can't get spectroscopic redshifts for everything. So spectroscopic redshifts are usually very good, but they're quite expensive to take. So often we have to infer redshifts from things like the colors of the galaxies, and that's not perfect, as you can see here from a plot from SDSS. So this is a bunch of their galaxies, and here we have the better redshift, the spectroscopic redshift, and here we have the photometric redshift. So, you know, ideally this is just a diagonal line, but there's obviously a bit of scatter. So we try to include this in our forecasts by accounting for the scatter that's expected, the different surveys. So when we look at weak lensing, we look at sources in multiple redshift bins, and we increase the size of these bins if the variance of if the expected scatter here is greater, then we have to make the bins larger so that we are more confident that our sources are actually at the redshifts we think they are. Okay, last note on the observables, I promise. So with the weak lensing, this is going to become relevant. It might seem kind of weird to mention at the moment, but I'll just tell you it's going to come up in a minute. So as I showed you before with Fisher forecasting, that log likelihood that tells you about the data, it usually has to be calculated numerically because you have to solve like a Boltzmann code for the matter power spectrum or whatever. And so you usually have to be able to take numerical derivatives with respect to the parameters. And we found that in the sort of standard publicly available Boltzmann codes that are commonly used, we use CAM for those who have used it before, but there are others. Incorporating nonlinear effects in the matter power spectrum caused us to, with these numerical derivatives, you have to assure that you have convergence in your numerical derivatives. This is just like a silly technical point. But you have to be able to test that as you go to like smaller steps or bigger steps in your numerical derivative, you have a convergent answer. It doesn't depend on your numerical method. And we found that when we were on nonlinear scales, the derivatives for the weak lensing, with respect to a couple of parameters, we just could not get convergent derivatives. And we can talk about why that might be. It's not super interesting, but the result was that in order to be conservative, we restricted to only linear scales for the weak lensing observables. So this is a Fourier space, so we have a maximum multiple of 300. And that sort of allowed us to have convergent derivatives. This is actually kind of in keeping with the rest of like the idea of what we're trying to do, which is because we have at least 10% uncertainties on how this nonlinear physics is going to behave at smaller scales anyway, it's not unreasonable actually to cut some of these scales. Although ideally you'd want to just marginalize over that uncertainty. We also will include, when I go through the results, we'll look at a case where we did include out to L max of 2000, so smaller scales. and we'll see, just to see, you know, what could happen if we had better modeling of those nonlinear structure formation behaviors. But I'll say now, and I'll say again when we get to that part, we should really take those with a grain of salt because we couldn't guarantee convergence of the numerical derivatives there. So I've just kind of talked about all of this, but these are the parameters that we include. So we're going to look at cases where we marginalize over all of these. We're going to look at cases where we fix certain ones of these and see what happens. We basically have, as we were saying, the lambda CDM parameters on this side, and then we have some systematic as well as extension parameters on the other side. We did choose to fix gravity to GR. Like, I am a person who works in deviations from GR, and I'm open to the objection that we should have also included deviations from GR, but we did end up fixing to GR, so sorry about that if that's what you care about. Okay, so, and then the final sort of thing before I get to the results is, okay, I keep talking about these like generations of surveys, you know, current, near future, more futuristic. If you're a person who wants to actually know which surveys I'm talking about, so for the CMB, we kind of had to choose ones to look at. There are multiple other things that could be swapped in and out at each generation, I think, but we had to fix to something, so this is what we picked. So current, we have Planck. We picked advanced ACTPOL for a CMB survey, and we picked, for the next generation or near generation, and we picked stage 4, which is a collaborative ground-based survey that's been proposed for the more futuristic one. For baryonic acoustic oscillations, we have BOSS from SDSS for the current survey, Euclid for the nearer future survey, and then the square kilometer array phase 2 for the further future survey. And for weak lensing, we picked dark energy survey for the current survey, Euclid again for the near future, and we picked LSST for the further future, even though Euclid and LSST actually have quite similar timelines. This is because we wanted to like get in the two different, like Euclid being the sort of having the deeper imaging. We wanted to be able to include Euclid and LSST lensing, so we've included both of them, even though LSST is only marginally further future than Euclid. Okay, I'm going to get onto the results now, and this actually isn't going to be too long of a section, so we're not going to run too far over. Does anybody have any questions at this stage?
No.
Yep.
Make this quick.
Okay.
You're doing late time Matterperce
prediction.
Pair galaxy pair correlation.
That's how we're modeling how you would get the BAO.
Because the CMB is way.
Yeah.
Lambda doesn't matter there.
For when? For the CMB.
Acceleration comes in later.
Right, yeah. So you do have something from the CMB lensing, that because you obviously lensing are sensitive to the later times, and ISW, integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect as well, but you're right. Yeah, there's less sensitivity. I mean, you can still have a constraint, I think. Oh, no, you're right. Yeah, no, that's where that sensitivity comes from. Yeah.
So, this L max is 300.
That's only for the lensing.
That's only for that.
Yeah. Sorry. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I should have been more clear about that. And actually, it's not even for the CMB lensing. It's only for the galaxy lensing because that was the only. That, so the CMB lensing is less sensitive to nonlinear effects because it's sensitive to a higher redshift, basically.
If you plot amount of power spectrum versus K.
Yeah.
Nonlinear starts coming in with larger K.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the earlier part is linear.
Yes, agree.
And so L maps equal to 300. What is the value of K? Maybe I should ask.
Right. No, but I know what you mean. So you're asking like, are you sure it's linear at those scales?
Yeah.
So people have different opinions about this. If you look at like something like HaloFit. The deviations start coming in somewhere between L of 100 and L of like 500, depending on the other assumptions you make. But we can talk about that after, maybe. Yeah. Okay. So results, I'll try to make this speedy. I've already told you the answer. We're not getting to 10 to the minus 4. So here's a plot that kind of tries to summarize some of the results. I'm aware this has a lot. It's a bit busy, so I'm just going to talk through it quickly. So on the right-hand side, we have the 95% confidence level constraint on omega k. On these like blue lines are probably the most important thing to look at. So on the x-axis, we have the redshift. But for these blue lines, which are showing different levels of constraint for different cases, these have nothing to do with this redshift axis. So it's not significant that they go out to different lengths. Just ignore that part. So on the top, we have the current real constraint from Planck and BAO. It's logarithmic, so it's kind of showing up weirdly. But that is 5 × 10⁻³. Here we have what might expect to get from the best combination of those three observables. So S4, LSST, and SK2 in some particular scenario, which I'll discuss in a second. And you can see it's nowhere near 10 to the minus 4. We also have this CV limited, which is cosmic variance limited case that we looked at, where this basically means the noise is heavily dominated by the cosmic variance, by the signal contribution to the covariance. So this is basically the best you can ever hope to do with these three observables. And even that is not really approaching 10 to the minus 4. But the other things here are showing like other effects you might pick up. So this is showing you that the second order perturbation theory term in the distance redshift relation, this red dotted line, might be important. You know, you might need to include that before you get to this more futuristic like survey combination. I think the thing about this plot is that I've told you that the point of what we're trying to do is to sort of unpack everything and make it very like clear and not brushing anything under the rug. This plot, if I just show you this, I'm not telling you anything about the assumptions that I make to go into these lines. So what we're going to do now is go through and actually unpack that stuff. So I'm going to put up a really gross table with a lot of numbers in it. And then I'm going to show some plots that explain the different scenarios in that table. So don't worry when I put this up. Like, I'm not expecting you to read all these numbers. I just want to use it to guide what we're thinking about in the next, just as we finish up. So this is sort of the main results table in the paper. So what we're seeing here, the numbers are the 95% confidence level constraints on omega k times 10 to the 4. So if we had 10 to the minus 4 as any of our constraints here, we would see a 1 in the table. For example, the 5 times 10 to the minus 3 constraint that is the current constraint would be a 50. And then on the farthest left, we have some of the different combinations of surveys. So the most kind of informative combinations at each stage. So we did look at, you know, the most advanced weak lensing survey combined with Planck, combined with the BAO survey from the middle, but I'm not showing every single one of those just to give kind of a more clear way to look at it. So what we found was that at each generation, the CMB survey was the most constraining. So we just first show that. Then at each generation, we show the CMB plus the BAO. We show the CMB plus the weak lensing. We show the CMB plus both. And for the cosmic variance limited case, we just show the combination of all three. So we have a number of columns here. They're showing different cases and different assumptions. So I'm going to go through each one quickly. Some of them have very straightforward interpretations, so it's not going to take too long. The first column that we see here says uninformative priors. So what that means is you just naively take the information from the observables that we're considering for these surveys, and you just do the forecast using that and no external information. And we marginalize over all those parameters that I showed you. So as you can see, these numbers are pretty big, especially at the current survey level. So I'll show you this. This is maybe an easier way to look at it. So this is just that column shown in a bar graph. So the orange ones are CMB only, yellow are CMB plus BAO, blue is CMB plus weak lensing, red is the combination of all three, and you have each generation and the cosmic variance limited case. So basically, what you can take away from this is that the yellow one in generation one would be the equivalent of the Planck plus Boss constraints, and that's like the current best constraint, but you can see it's almost at 400, whereas I told you that that should be 50. And so what you're seeing there is the fact that, you know, in that constraint, they assume W equals minus one, for example, so that immediately breaks the geometric degeneracy. And they also have some other priors, which I'll talk about next. So this kind of gives you an idea. This is like the very baseline of what you can do. So these are quite large. So the next case is mild priors. So this means we include some conservative level of information from external probes. So this is sort of what you might actually do if you were trying to do this type of constraint, but you still wanted to marginalize over all of those parameters. So these are things like including sort of very conservative external priors on the optical depth within the CMB, on the on the dark energy equation of state parameters, like very conservative. I mean things like, I think we have a prior of like plus or minus, like minus one plus or minus one on W naught. So we're not making any like unreasonable assumptions. We're just including that information from something like a supernova survey, but not at the level where we're actually worried about like introducing dependence on the modeling from those other probes. So this is kind of meant to represent what you might actually do. And so this is comparing the gray bars are what I just showed you, the uninformative priors, and the colored bars, again with the same color coding for the different observables, are the mild priors. So you can see there's like a considerable improvement in certain cases, especially with the CMB plus BAO constraints. Okay, and I mean, this is gonna be a recurring theme that the cosmic variance limited thing is gonna be just small in all cases. And we'll get to that at the end. Okay, next case, so now we're gonna assume those mild priors in for the next few columns, but also fix a particular parameter to see what effect that parameter actually has on the constraints. So this is the case where we're fixing the dark energy equation of state. So basically we're fixing to like a lambda in the lambda CDM, fixing to W equals minus one. And this is very common choice in, you know, depending on who's doing the analysis. And obviously if you do that, your constraints can be dramatically improved because you're breaking the geometric degeneracy. So for example, in generation one, this yellow thing, so now the gray bars are the mild priors. So that'll be the case for the next, all of the rest of the plots I show. Gray bars are the mild priors to compare against, and the colored bars are fixing a particular parameter. The yellow on the generation one is the equivalent to the current constraint. So that I told you should be around 50. Now you can see it is around 50 from fixing that parameter. Again, the CMB plus BAO, this has the greatest effect on those ones. Okay, now I'm gonna get into a few parameters that have less of an obvious effect, which is good news for us because it means we learned that it actually doesn't matter so much about whether you marginalize over these or not. So the first one is the alpha S. So this is that parameter that deals with the fact that you don't know exactly what happens to the BAO in the nonlinear physics. And when we go from having like quite a conservative amount of uncertainty on this to fixing it, there's completely negligible changes, which is surprising maybe, but good news, because it means if you get your uncertainty wrong on that, you're not gonna kill, you're not gonna like get totally the wrong answer. Next one we have is the neutrino mass. So I talked about this a bit at the beginning. This is a common one that, you know, it depends on your analysis. Do you care about constraints on massive neutrinos or not? And so for this one, I mean, perhaps unsurprisingly, there's a small effect or like a considerable effect, especially in the case where you're looking at CMB alone. And that's because, well, when I'm saying CMB alone, I'm including CMB lensing, and we expect the neutrino mass. If you have a higher neutrino mass, your CMB lensing power spectrum amplitude changes. And you can compensate for that in your temperature power spectrum by changing the curvature. So that's why you have that degeneracy. We're seeing That the change is actually small, though, once you combine all the observables, which is nice to be reassured of, that introducing something like BAO does help break that degeneracy. The next one is that optical depth parameter that I mentioned before. So, sorry, I can see the next plot, but you can't. So this is something that has been spoken about as being potentially problematic for constraints on omega k. Interestingly, it looks like for these three observables, for at least up until the next sort of the most futuristic surveys we consider, the gains are marginal when you get a perfect constraint on this. It's hard to see here. Actually, I'll just go back to the table just to point this out. But if you look at the cosmic variance limited case, fixing tau, I mean, it's not much of a gain, but it is the greatest gain versus the mild priors case in the cosmic variance limited row just from fixing a parameter. So I guess it's interesting to see that, you know, we maybe don't need to worry too much about the, in terms of omega k, about the constraint on tau for the foreseeable future, but as we go further and further, we might need to actually worry about pinning that down. I mean, I think that's going to happen naturally with more advanced CMB surveys. But okay, the next couple of parameters, we're going to see very little difference happening. So this one is the amplitude of the intrinsic alignment cross correlations. That's like the extra extra correlation in ellipticities from weak lensing. This has a small effect on the weak lensing constraint, but it pretty much is negligible when you combine it with the two other constraints, because as you can see, the BAO constraint is just so much, BAO plus CMB constraint is just so much better. You have that pretty much washing out. Final fixing parameter, galaxy bias. Again, this isn't having much of an effect, like pretty much negligible. Okay, and this is slightly different. So we're almost at the end. This is the case that I mentioned before, where we actually do consider what would happen if we could get a better understanding of those nonlinear scales for including weak lensing, or, you know, as you mentioned, like just the matter power spectrum in terms of K. We haven't considered that here, but it would be a similar question. So in this case, we include out to L of 2000 for the weak lensing, and we actually do see a reasonable improvement. Like there's something going on here, which is nice to see, because as we had seen before, like especially in the mild priors case, you can see on this plot, the lensing plus CMB is just kind of pales in comparison to the BAO plus CMB. But when you do include out to these more nonlinear scales, there could be potential for significant contribution to the constraint. So that's good to know. Okay, and the final one is the case where we fix everything. And so as I've been flashing back to this table, you might have been waiting for me to get to this column, because it's the only column where we have numbers below 1, which is what I told you that would be getting down below 10 to the minus 4. So we fix literally everything other than omega k. So this is, you know, all of your lambda CDM parameters, assuming we have perfect knowledge of them. And of what we considered for these observables, only in this case do we get to this sort of curvature floor value. And you get to it just with the CMB. So you can see when you have that, you don't gain anything from adding the other two observables. You would even get pretty close with the sort of near future experiments. Of course, this isn't really realistic at all, right? You're always gonna have some uncertainty on your other parameters, and your best constraints are likely to come from your CMB survey, which is already included in here. So this isn't really a realistic scenario, which is why I told you at the beginning we wouldn't really be getting to those really high constraint levels, because I wouldn't say that this is something we could ever really achieve. So this is the equivalent plot. Obviously, the bars are tiny. Just to give you, that's a log scale, so you can actually see the bars. But I think you could even see from the table because all the numbers are the same in that column, that you're not going to get down to that level we talked about. Okay, I am just about done. I'm aware we've run over. Just as a summary of what I've just said, there are a few parameters where there's some kind of interesting effect. So obviously the geometric degeneracy, a few things that have known degeneracies, there's some considerable effect. This is, I think, maybe the more interesting thing, is that things that represent systematic, potential systematic errors, uncertainties in your systematic effects, seem to have almost no effect. So that's actually great news, because we were trying to see if maybe like people were being overly optimistic in terms of our ability to deal with this kind of errors. And at least in terms of these things that we've included, doesn't seem to be too much the case, which is good. We also see that going down to more nonlinear scales in lensing, if we were able to do that, that makes somewhat of a difference. And that only fixing all those other parameters actually gets you to the curvature floor. So second last slide, I promise. This is just a couple of interesting things we saw in terms of those systematic effects. So one thing is that we noticed was that even though fixing or varying the intrinsic alignment amplitude didn't make much of a difference, actually increasing the assumed fiducial value of the intrinsic alignment, so like what you assume to be your true contribution, caused better constraints. Not hugely better, but better. And that's just kind of an interesting side note, because people are thinking more and more about using these intrinsic alignment correlations as probes of cosmology. So this is maybe an example of where that could be explored more. We also, I just want to point out that we assume a pretty simplistic model for photometric redshifts. But there's a lot of work going into this, and it's just not going to be that simple. So there's more to be done in terms of understanding that. And again, of course, things I mentioned before that we need to worry about in terms of large-scale structure effects. And this, yeah, so this sort of leads back into the last thing I want to say. I mean, I've already sort of driven home these points, I think. So going to that, looking at that table, the reason I say the best we're likely to do with these three observables is 10 to the minus 3, actually, I'll just flash back to the table for a second to make this point, is that sort of even in just with the mild priors case, with the three best surveys, you are at about 2 times 10 to the minus 3. Fixing certain parameters can get you a bit better than that. And assuming that we are able to get like auxiliary constraints from other surveys that might give us slightly better, more confident, like mild priors, you might be able to get down 10 to the minus 3. So that's why I'm saying that as like a best guess. It's not meant to be a sort of hard and fast number. I should specify that I don't mean to say that we'll never, never, never get to the curvature floor. It could be possible that other observables, there's been interest in using 21 centimeter intensity mapping. I haven't considered like the broadband shape of the power spectrum, as has been pointed out. So it's possible that you will be able to get there, just not with the three observables that we've considered. And I just want to close by again saying, as I'm glad you've actually brought up so many different things during the talk, because I think it really exemplifies the problem that I was highlighting when I was saying this thing about like constraints on curvature being potentially useful as a litmus test, because we don't agree on how to interpret these things, right? Like I say I've got a constraint on omega k, and you say you've assumed lambda CVM, then we need to have a conversation. And that's true from the theoretical perspective. It's true from the perspective of systematic error analysis. One group says, I've modeled my systematic error correctly. Another group says, no, you haven't. That's totally wrong. I think omega k is interesting because it's already constrained at such a high level, and because we have the potential to go to these really precision level constraints, even just pushing down to better constraints for the sake of making sure that we can do it and making sure that we can agree on what we see when we get there is potentially valuable. So I've already gone over, and I think people probably want to eat lunch and stuff like that. So maybe I'll stop there. And if you have any more questions, or I'm also happy to talk later if you'd rather talk more one-on-one. So thanks so much for having me at your meeting. Okay. Hi.
So in the cosmic variance limit of the forecast line, what's
the assumption? Or
yeah,
so
like what L max or what rest?
Oh right. I should say, so for the cosmic limited forecast stuff, we assumed an L max of like 5,000. We went really we went as hard as we could to try and see if we could get. So I'll go back to the table. Yeah, so with LMAX of 5,000, we pushed the noise contributions to just be like negligible compared to the, so you having just like these ridiculously high volume densities for your galaxies. Was there another specific thing besides LMAX you were wondering about? Or?
Yeah, I mean, for example, large scale structure survey, like what redshift range do you assume you know at the position of every galaxy?
I think,
or even if you knew all the matter in the universe up to some redshift.
No, it's not that much. I think I'd have to go and check specifically, but I believe what we did, so yeah, I mean, I can tell you what the lensing was and the CMB was. My collaborator, Phil Bull, actually did the calculation for the BAO. So I would have to go back into my notes for that one. For the lensing, we basically, because the noise term for the lensing is just proportional to the ensemble shape noise over the number of lens source pairs. And that's dependent on your surface densities of your sources and lenses, or rather, that's for galaxy-galaxy lensing. It's dependent on the number density of sources. And so in that case, we basically cranked that number up until the noise term was negligible, which was quite a high surface density. But I would have to check for the BAO, sorry.
And another question about, so when you said that these bias parameters, B and alpha S, don't matter so much, is that because you cut off weak lensing at 300?
So lensing for cosmic shear, so like shear-shear correlations, doesn't depend on the galaxy bias. So that's only related, that parameter was only in the BAO part. And alpha S also doesn't come into lensing. So yeah, so it wasn't, those weren't related, yeah. Yeah, galaxy bias comes in when you do galaxy-galaxy lensing, but not for shear-shear, if that makes sense.
No,
okay.
Can you get close to the level of fixed all constraints by fixing some subset instead of the
right. Parameters? So I think the biggest thing is the constraint on omega m, so the matter fractional density, and also on the Hubble constant. So those are the two that make the biggest difference in terms of the lambda CDM parameters. So you can, but remember that we have, like, this includes the information from the CMB on constraining those parameters from S4. So that's like a pretty strong constraint on those parameters. We are marginalizing over other things. So probably an interesting column to have, which I don't have here, is just looking at like, like fixing everything, but then, you know, just marginalizing over the other lambda CDM parameters. That maybe that's interesting, and just fixing like all the rest. Yeah, I probably should have shown that. The other thing about H is that so often people do include priors from H, and for H like the Hubble parameter, and you can make a strong case for doing that. But we chose not to do it because at the moment there's a lot of tension about which priors you pick, because they don't all agree with each other from different like external constraints. And so to be sort of more conservative, we didn't include it, partially because, you know, if you assume a prior for H and you see a non-flat universe, no one's going to believe you. Like, they're just going to be like, well, your H prior is wrong, so that's too bad for you. sure.
When you fit the angular power spectrum, CFP,
yeah.
TT,
yeah.
The Planck data has it, six parameters.
Yep.
The Planck data has the omegas down to 4-5 decimal places.
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah. So that's when you're reaching the floor there.
In what way?
Well, this is an amazing fit to be
Right. But what you're seeing is that, like, yeah, I see what you mean. Which is, I guess, again, why it would be interesting to have that column with the just marginalizing over those parameters. Yeah. Yeah, you. Yeah, because you. It's a derived parameter. Yeah.
So that's a parameter.
Yeah.
Being there, it just actually played much of a role. You see, it's two points, the pair correlation of gaps. It's important if you fit the matter transfer function.
Yeah.
Square enough to get the power.
Yeah.
And, the omega n is very important.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yes, I agree. You're right.
So
thank you.
Probably break for lunch, so let's
thank you.